Thanks very much. I'm going to try to talk about Mozart's depiction of the mind of a sexual psychopath. to see both how Mozart does it and also what it can help us to understand about sexual psychopathy, how Mozart and Da Ponte, his librettos together, show us very interestingly, I think, this particular sort of mental state. Now, Don Giovanni is an opera full of enigmas, and the question, I think, is how to account for its impact on us. Why, although Don Giovanni is a murderer himself and a destroyer of women and of men, is the response of quite a lot of women in discussing the opera that they are strangely attracted to him, and of quite a number of men that they'd like to be him or be like him? What accounts for these reactions of ours? That's the question, and I think that analytic understanding can help to shed some light on it. Just a brief bit of background. I expect that most people here will know the opera, but it was first performed in 1787 in Prague, shortly afterwards in a slightly altered version in Vienna. And his librettist, Lorenzo da Ponte, retold a story that seems to have originated in a play by a Spanish monk under the pseudonym Tirso de Molina in about 1630, and which was well known in the 18th century and in Vienna. In fact, it was the subject of a number of other operas and also of puppet shows. So it would be a well-known story. Mozart and Da Ponte's version tells how Don Giovanni, a nobleman given to constant seduction of women, kills the father of a woman who he's been trying to seduce, Donna Anna. He's then pursued by a former lover of his, Donna Elvira, and also by Donna Anna and her fiancé, Don Ottavio. Don Giovanni then attempts to seduce a peasant woman, Zerlina, on the day of her wedding to Mazzetto, and Don Giovanni's manservant and foil, Leporello, accompanies him throughout. Eventually, the ghost of Donna Anna's father appears to Don Giovanni in the form of a statue, commanding him to repent. Don Giovanni invites the ghost to dinner, but steadfastly refuses to accede to his demand that he repent, even while the ghost, the so-called stone guest, drags him to hell. Now, we don't any longer believe in people being dragged to hell for sexual promiscuity, or even for rape or murder, nor, it seems likely, did Mozart's 18th century audience. And yet the opera has what Kierkegaard, who was obsessed with the opera, called a great and unsettling power. That's Kierkegaard quoted by Bernard Williams. And this is partly, I think, due to the contrast of the emotional worlds in the piece, between the forbidding intensity of the statue's music, the rich sensuality of much of the music, particularly that sung by all the women characters, which is a key thing I'll come back to later on, and the farcical elements of the story. And these contrasts aren't to be explained away by a question of what the genre is, whether it's opera buffa or opera seria and so on. I think the complexity of response starts right from the beginning of the opera, and I'll play you a bit in a minute. It arises from the contrast between, on the one hand, the engulfing intensity and darkness of the stone guest's music that begins the opera and almost ends it, and on the other hand, the world of sexualized rush and flight that's so characteristic of Don Giovanni himself and of the plot as a whole. And this division is placed before us immediately at the start with the overture. The first two pages of the vocal score of Don Giovanni portray utterly different worlds. The first page is in an ominous and menacing D minor, a key which had particular associations of gravity, intensity, and seriousness for Mozart, if you think of his Requiem. After 10 bars, I'll play this in a minute, 10 bars which evoke foreboding and which establish the key and the pulse, a lurching, syncopated figure takes over, and the pulse against which it is set has all but disappeared. We later find out that this is the music of the stone guest, the avenging ghost of the Commendatore, the man Don Giovanni has murdered, the father of Donna Anna, who returns at the end of the opera to invite him to repent and to pull him to hell when he refuses to repent. Already this music has a force unprecedented in opera and uses trombones in a way that was very unusual at the time in opera. But then after only 30 bars, we're suddenly in a different world altogether. A bright D major, a brisk comic opera overture. Interestingly, the music of which doesn't recur at any point in the opera. So could we hear music track one, do you think? To a minor, sometimes remote key, in the middle of something rapid and comic. It happens several times, notably right at the end of the opera, where there are actually two endings. The world of supernatural darkness, of the being pulled into the flames of hell, is superseded by a bright presto choric finale. And I'll come back to the question of the two endings later on. Now, how can we understand these contrasts and make sense of our response? This inevitably introduces the question of how we make sense of Don Giovanni himself. Some commentators see him simply as a figure of transcendent vitality. And isn't he amazing? Now, in my view, they turned a blind eye, as Don Giovanni himself would like us to the fact that he's an extremely cruel serial adulterer who ruins women's lives and castrates and humiliates men just as compulsively. I think that analytic, psychoanalytic understanding can help us to make sense of these apparently totally separated worlds, the dark, deadly one, and the world of sexualized flight, as divided aspects of the same reality. We can see the opera as taking us right inside an emotional dilemma and conflict that is also ours, and into a particular outcome of this emotional dilemma, which amounts to a catastrophe. It can also help us to understand one of the interesting things that many people have pointed to, which is that Giovanni himself is quite blank as a character. Alone of all the characters, he has no self-reflective aria. His only solo aria, Finca del Vino, roughly speaking, till they have got some wine and are hot-headed, is a brief, brutally simple, insistent hammering of sexual appetite. He is reveling in the perverse mixing up of roles, boundaries, ages, and he orders anarchy, telling Leporello to let all the dances be mixed up and played at once. And actually, Mozart, in a very sort of classical version of anarchy, actually arranges this. He has three dances going on simultaneously with different time signatures. It's very cunning during the finale of the first act. And I'll play with this his only aria, his only self-reflective aria, and it's over very quickly. We could try.
Calda la testa, dalla testa fa tremare. Se trovi in piazza qualche ragazza, te come quella cerca menar, te come quella cerca menar, cerca menar, cerca menar. Senza alcun ordine la razza sia, il vino ecco, chi la follia, chi la mala, fare ballar, chi il vino ecco, fare ballar, chi la follia, fare ballar, chi la mala, fare ballar. E di frattanto dall'altro canto, con questa quella amore già, amore già, amore già. E malica, tua mattina, tua ragina devi mentar. Aglia malista, tua ragina devi mentar. Se fai piazza qualche ragazza, è quella che ricomandà. Aglia malista, tua mattina, tua ragina devi mentar. Se fai piazza qualche ragazza, è quella che ricomandà.
In it, and it's got this very anxious pounding pulse. You could think of the anxious pounding of a baby's heart or something of this kind. And what he's doing is ordering Leporello to bring more women, so to be added to his list, get more girls from the village for me. But the sort of simplicity and emptiness of the music is very striking. Now, this split that I'm talking about between these two utterly different worlds of the first two pages of the opera starts to make more sense, I think, if one thinks of it as conveying crucial information about the characters, especially about Giovanni. He presents himself to us and to the world in the mode, as one might say, of page two of the score, of rapid light bustle. He appears as arrogant, intolerant of any boundary or limit or restriction, legal, sexual, or of social class. He's in a rush. He's larger than life. His appetite is boundless. He keeps saying, I need women like I need air and like I need food and so on. He evacuates pain into the women around him, yet appears to have no guilt. In short, he functions by means of mania. It's completely essential to him that a sense of being abandoned or depressed is not in him but in his object. The manic patient, like Giovanni, is on the run from a side of him or herself that is unbearable, in particular from menacing guilt. Giovanni cannot bear guilt and becomes furious when accused. Guilt, the key to mania, comprises both persecutory and depressive elements, both the fear of retaliation by someone we've hurt or damaged, and an identification with that damaged person accompanied by remorse. If the latter is predominant, the depression that results is acutely painful and difficult to bear for long. One form of defense is to regress to a more primitive, paranoid form of functioning, an intrinsic part of the manic defense. But an alternative defense, as I say, is to deny the psychic reality of the damage we've caused, the method of mania, Giovanni's method. Because it entails further damage by the continuing evacuation of pain into others, it's intrinsically both self-perpetuating and self-defeating. In the opera, we can see what would be Giovanni's conscience if he were to stop long enough to let it catch up with him. We especially see it in the form of Donna Anna and Donna Elvira, both treated very badly by him, who pursue him throughout the opera. Elvira, in particular, arrives on the scene whenever Giovanni's appetite is about to be satisfied, as if representing both the reproach and exhibiting the suffering that he is unable to tolerate. And it's notable that Elvira also has the real vulnerable personality that Giovanni lacks. She's almost a sort of, not quite a figure of fun. I think in the 18th century, a noblewoman who arrived on stage carrying her own suitcases would have been a comic figure. And yet we're invited to sympathize with her pain. She has particular sort of jagged arpeggios that are very painful. And in the 18th century, the fallen woman, she was a fallen woman because of her rape by Giovanni, was a tragic figure, and many of them killed themselves because you were completely thrown out of society. So there was something both comic and very dark about Elvira and her situation. So Giovanni's emptiness as a character and his inability to tolerate guilt are connected. To understand why this is so, we need to look at what accounts for the level and unbearability of his guilt. His guilt has a murderously intense quality that is exactly, and I think wonderfully, shown in the page one music, which returns as he is dragged to hell. This is exactly the murderous punishment that the manic patient is in flight from, and which, when it catches up to them, can lead them to kill themselves, as Giovanni in a sense does. But what has Giovanni done that makes this murderous punishment psychologically justified? There are three levels to this, I think. First, if punishment by death is felt, both to us and to Giovanni, to be psychologically justified and appropriate, as I'm suggesting, then he must have killed someone or something. Literally, he's killed the commendatore, the father of the woman he's tried to rape. But who or what does the commendatore represent? And the background here, of course, is the Oedipus complex. And it's no coincidence that Don Giovanni was Freud's favorite opera. And no coincidence either that it was during the writing of Giovanni that Mozart's father died. And Mozart, as we know, had a famously difficult relationship with his father. And emancipating himself from his rule and his support, but his tyranny as well, was a major thing for Mozart. Giovanni's literal murder of Anna's father also represented the symbolic murder of the father principle, the principle of boundaries, which he attacks in various forms throughout the opera. As soon as he sees a wedding about to take place, he tries to take Zelina, the bride, away from her husband-to-be, Mazzetto. In asserting his droit de seigneur, an institutionalized version of an attack on the couple, and living out his infantile fantasy that he is the father without constraint or limits, he also breaches a further boundary, one of class. This world of violent appropriation and equally violent punishment is characteristic of the very early Oedipus complex, of children's play between the ages of 2 and 4, say. In normal development, the violence, and hence the point that it is felt to be deserved, become modified, defended against, and sublimated. If reality in the form of the child's smallness and dependency can become more or less accepted, then we can renounce the claim that we are our mother or our father's partner. And as we know, this achievement takes a great deal of emotional work and pain. The pain derives in part from the blow to our narcissism that comes from having to accept our smallness, that we are not it, the all-powerful parent. In part, it arises from the guilt about the damage that we believe we've caused in our fantasies of killing and taking over the father's place. Remorse of this kind about damage that we have caused is of a different quality from the deadly eye-for-an-eye punitiveness that accompanies the earlier claims to be the parent. This more mature guilt also sets in train reparation and making amends, which is one of the main ways of modifying and making bearable the pain of this stage of development. If in some way through trauma or through innate factors or through the lack of an emotionally available person to help the child to work through the pain of this stage and gradual modification and renunciation are not possible, the result can be the perpetuation of very early mental life with its longings and dangers. And this is the core of psychotic, borderline, hysterical and narcissistic personality disorders. Now beneath this level, I think, is a second one. In sexual psychopathy, which we see in Don Giovanni, the same features are prominent. But underneath the same Oedipal wish to take over, control, and become the father by killing him is an additional level of disturbance that makes an ordinary negotiation of the Oedipus complex even more difficult. This is characterized by immense cruelty to women, disguised as love for women. If one saw a sexual psychopath like Don Giovanni as a patient and heard of his boasts and his conquests, his one-night stands, etc., one would inevitably think that this was a reversal, in which his victims were taking the place formerly occupied by himself. That is, that the women, and not only the women, but also Mazzetto, Ottavio, and Leporello, who he was attacking in these ways, were having to suffer what he had once suffered but couldn't tolerate, feelings of belittlement, humiliation, rejection, and degradation. This reversal is his method of psychic survival. But underneath these two layers, I think, is a third one, perhaps the most primitive base for Don Giovanni's phallic defense, which I think is a dread of fusion with the mother. This masquerades as a wish to reunite with her repetitively through sex. His so-called conquests are actually obliterations of each woman's specific identity, so that they become merely a number, an entry in Leporello's catalogue, which I'll play you a little bit of in a minute. In Italy, 640, in Germany, 230, 100 in France, 91 in Turkey, but in Spain, 1,003. The blankness and precision are perhaps reminiscent of the careful bookkeeping of those running the tourist concentration camps, and both conceal and reveal a dread and memory of being conquered and obliterated as a child. The statistics in the aria appear to underline the boundlessness of Giovanni's appetite. In fact, they emphasize the intensity of the underlying terror. For all his talk of needing women like he needs air, it's paradoxically the repeated reassurance of his separateness from each woman that he abandons that matters to him. And we can see in these deeper levels of the phallic defense the aftermath of a catastrophic beginning in life for him, detectable mainly in its effects on others, rather as the level of background radiation in the universe is thought to be evidence for the occurrence of the Big Bang. Do we have track 3, do you think?
Madamina, il catalogo è questo, delle belle chiamo al padron mio, un catalogo agli che ho fatto io. Osservate, leggete con me, osservate, leggete con me. Italia 640, in Germania 231, 100 in Francia, in Turchia 91, ma in Spagna, ma in Spagna sono già 1003, 1003, 1003. Queste contadine, cameriere cittadine, guardo d'esse baronesse, marchesone principesse, mandate in ogni grado, ogni tempo, ogni età, ogni forma, ogni età. In Italia, 640, in Lavagna, 230.
La piccina, la piccina. He says these are the prize. Now, for someone like Don Giovanni, the Oedipus complex is unnegotiable. Renouncing his claims to be his own or to be the father's phallus is unthinkable. His manic attempted solution to his dilemma actually compounds the problem as it inflicts further damage. And his belief is that atonement for crimes of this magnitude is impossible. Instead, retribution is the consequence. Even at the level of whole object sexuality, this would take the form of his being castrated, having his penis appropriated in turn. However, at the deeper, more infantile level that I'm suggesting is relevant to Don Giovanni, punishment amounts to the very thing that the sexualized defense is meant to protect against, utter annihilation, as punishment for annihilating both his father and his mother. And it's this most primitive form of a superego that Don Giovanni is faced with at the end of the opera by the ghost of the murdered father. Now, the leading mechanism in Don Giovanni's mania is projective identification. And of course, sex, with its primitive instinctual urges, its bodily connection, and its longings to be in or filled by a partner, is particularly suited to being the vehicle for projective identification. The fantasy of projective identification has two complementary elements. In one, the subject has a fantasy of evacuating parts of his or her mind into someone else, often accompanied by subtle behaviours in such a way that the object is indeed caused to feel things that correlate with what the subject was in fantasy wishing to expel. In the other, the subject has a fantasy of acquiring the characteristics of the object. Don Giovanni wishes to expel his hated infantile neediness and humiliation into his partners, and also into the male characters, because all the male characters are attacked or humiliated or cuckolded. At the same time, he wishes to acquire what he unconsciously takes to be the adult potency and invulnerability of both the male and the female characters. He tries to acquire the never detumescent power of the father's phallus, and at the same time to become the ideal, perpetually needed figure of the mother. The end result of projective identification always tends to seem like a caricature or a mask, to have an unreal cardboard quality to it, as it is a simulacrum of qualities that are real in the object, the outcome of processes of development, but which are false in the subject. And this is true of Don Giovanni's so-called potency and invulnerability. And there's a rather telling stage reference, or one stage direction, constantly trying to hide himself is the stage direction. And actually this happens repeatedly in the opera. He uses other people's tunes. He appears in disguise as Leporello at one point. Most of his music is in fact a copy of somebody else's music, including Don Elvira's at one point. And in his second seduction, which is of Elvira's maid, he uses what was a common pop tune at the time. So he's almost never himself. Now we can work through the Oedipus complex when we feel understood and emotionally contained by another person's mind. And pathology can carry also a striving for health. And maybe there's something that Don Giovanni is looking for, perhaps, in his serial conquests, for a woman who will understand this need and not collude with his sexualization of what is actually much more primitive and infantile in him. It is this that people like Don Giovanni, male or female, because there are female versions as well, of course, are looking for when they come into analysis. And it matters desperately to them that no matter how they try to seduce their analyst or to sexualize their relationship with him or her, that the analyst remains enrolled as someone trying to understand them. I sometimes think of the women who write to prisoners on death row, that they see a sort of infantile need, and whatever it means for the women themselves, that this is the sort of response that something like Giovanni is perhaps looking for as well. We are now in a better position, I think, to see how Don Giovanni is an adult who is stuck, like many psychopathic or narcissistic patients, with the mind of a very young child. And not only that, but of a young child using particular omnipotent defences. He is stuck in a world of phallic narcissism. I want to go on to think about the consequences for Giovanni as a character and as a seducer. It's no surprise to find that he's no character of himself and his music is quite blank. Although he alleges he has transcendent power and individuality, in fact, his music depicts him as fitting in with whoever he is, wearing a succession of masks. Paradoxically, his very characterlessness is perhaps the clue to his seductiveness. His two main seductions, of Zelina and of Elvira's maid, seem to indicate as much. In the first, which I'll play you, La ci darem la mano, there with your hand in mind, when he's seducing the peasant girl, Zelina, who's about to get married, he produces a beautiful, rather blank, almost lullaby-like, 8-bar phrase. In itself, it's entirely self-contained and symmetrical, moving somewhat formulaically from the tonic key to the dominant and back again, the most minimal conventional move possible, and back to the tonic. In itself, it musically stays put. It's Zelina, not he, who is aroused, takes up the tune, elaborates it, and runs with it, conveying that it is she, not he, who is aroused, erotically involved, and they become very quickly joined together musically, singing the same line 3 notes apart. What's so interesting here is that we can hear and see how Giovanni elicits in Zelina through his lullaby of seduction, his own infantile neediness. I think this is why his seduction of her seems so shocking, that he is exploiting her deepest vulnerability, her own infantile need. And it's her second attempted seduction has the same lullaby-like quality. It was played in the E&O production by him ringing a sex line. It had the same sort of quality. I'll play you this, the La Ci Do Re Mi La Mano, because you can hear projective identification in action, actually. So if we could have track...
La Ci Do Re Mi La Mano, la mi dirai di sì, venito del lontano, partiam venire da qui.
Produce such beauty, we can see not only how John Giovanni's neediness is projected into and elicited in his partner and in us, but also his envy of the creative capacity of his mother. We and Zerlina are meant to admire his production. At the same time, Giovanni evacuates his jealousy, his dread that someone else has possession of the object, into Zerlina's new husband, Mazzetto. And in the middle of all this, we, like Zerlina, overlook both the song's dangerousness and its odd asexuality. Giovanni's narcissism is conveyed in this, that he is complete and doesn't need anyone else. And this has the effect of arousing the neediness, including sexual neediness, in Zerlina, that he is tacitly denying and projecting. The people around someone as narcissistic as Giovanni become convinced that if only they could get, or have, him, their need would be satisfied. In fact, we know from his almost animal account of his scenting a woman, of needing women as he needs food or air, that he's profoundly needy, with a sort of oral insatiability like that of a very young baby. And as with a very young baby, his interest in women is not in them as whole people, but only in parts of them. His hedonism, for all its swagger, is revealed as banal and infantile. The powerful message to the woman perhaps accounts for the appeal in opera and in life as well, of such narcissistic and psychopathic people. The message is that here is someone without need who can satisfy all your own needs. And this is very flattering, of course, because if somebody who's got everything needs you, you must be amazing. Now, Mozart and his librettist Don Da Ponte contrast Giovanni's world of phallic narcissism with other more complex worlds. They oppose it with the worlds of the women, and particularly with the world of the relationship between Zerlina and Mazzetto. The music of all the women conveys great sensuality, quite unlike Giovanni's. His either takes the form of a friend's frenetic masturbatory battering ram, which I played you, a lullaby, La Ci Darem, or in the case of his serenade to Elvira's maid, an imitation of a contemporary folk song. Now compare that with what I'm about to play you, the power of Anna's impassioned cries for help at the start and the strength and sensuality of her aria calling for revenge. He is the one who robbed me of my honour. This exalted march, with its deliberately dated slow two-in-a-bar pulse, suitable for Anna's aristocratic status, is characteristic of a different genre of opera, the more old-fashioned opera seria, which typically portrayed noble and mythical characters like in Gluck or Handel, but also as in Idomeneo. Anna could, in terms of the music she's given, be a goddess. And you'll hear the intensity of her anger and pain conveyed in the power of her rushing coloratura scales. And this music, like a sublimated scream, perhaps reveals what Don Giovanni might express if only he could bear to know about his own rage at being tantalized and abandoned at some very early stage in his life. But exactly because he can't know or process this, he forces his undigested pain into Anna and Elvira. And the interesting thing which I'll invite you to listen out for is how the music, unlike Giovanni's aria, which goes bom, 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 tonic, dominant, actually moves through many keys in a very complex way, changes mood, then returns to the cry for revenge. So if we could try track 5. And her mood changes, something that Don Giovanni is really incapable of. But the orchestration has got a different and richer quality in both in her aria and in Elvira's. Perhaps the greatest contrast of the emotional world of Don Giovanni is the relationship between Zerlina and Mazzetto. Their roles come from the tradition of pastoral, depicting the genuine feelings of simple rustic people, a tradition that had an extra meaning at this point in the 18th century when revolution was in the air throughout Europe and there was an uneasy awareness of the fragility of class relations. Despite this background, Mazzetto and Zerlina's relationship is not idealized or seen purely in comic terms, which in terms of the opera of the time it could have been, but is depicted as both rich and ordinary. And the relationship between the two of them is very interesting, very erotic in a way that isn't true of Don Giovanni's relationship with women. And the orchestration is particularly interesting. But we haven't got time to go into that now. But the relationship between the two of them is really striking and quite different from Don Giovanni's relationship with women. Now, the end of the opera doesn't resolve this contradiction between the worlds of manic rush and denial on the one hand and of suicidal breakdown on the other. There is no resolution within Giovanni himself. Indeed, he refuses any such capitulation, as it would seem to him, and as seems entirely accurate psychologically. Instead, he unflinchingly takes the commendatore's ghost's hand in a dark echo of his instruction to Zelina to link hands and defies the ghost's orders to repent. The other characters arrive, Leporello tells them what's happened, and the harmonic tension, almost unbearable during the music of the stone guest, rapidly resolves after a dissonant clash between Anna and Elvira's lines. So that's one ending. But then the buffa characters then introduce what they call the oldest song, l'antichissima canzone, the final presto chorus in which all the surviving cast sing, "This is the end of the sinner's game, his life and death are just the same." There's a rather sort of pat closing it all down quality. The music here is brisk and hard, with just a nod in the direction of a formal seria fugal ending. Here, the happy ending, the lieto fine, which was a sort of characteristic of opera buffa, attempts to establish, like the choric endings of Greek and Shakespearean tragedies, the continuance of the normal order after its rupture during the opera. But the thinness and brittleness of this music convey that developmentally the characters have indeed reverted to the oldest song, the most primitive reaction. Giovanni has been able to achieve no insight by the end of the opera, and the other characters in turn adopt his trademark manic stance. Everything's fine, the other character, the baddie, has gone to hell. Unable to make sense of the way in which they are left utterly changed, they disown and project their own destructiveness into Giovanni, just as Giovanni has been doing to others throughout the opera. In this sense, the apparently conventional happy ending is in fact highly unconventional. Far from being convincingly happy, it is darkly ironic. To conclude, we can now see why the opera is so disturbing, I think. By the rhetorical power of the music, so much of which hints at a world of perverse darkness underneath its beauty, we are invited into identification with Giovanni's empty phallic power, and we are seduced, along with Zelina, Anna, Elvira, and Elvira's maid. But we also identify with Elvira's confused love for her abuser, and with Anna's fury, and with Anna's own Oedipal attachment to her dead father, which makes it so hard for her to imagine moving on in her relationship with Ottavio. I think the greatness of Mozart's achievement is to draw us into these conflicting identifications while avoiding moralizing, which would be the world of the puppet show in contrast. We understand something about what it feels like to be an abandoned child, a sexual psychopath, who has to use manic phallic narcissism to survive a psychic catastrophe by driving his agony into others. We understand this because the music evokes in us our own abandonment and our own sexual violence, our Oedipal claims and our own remorse. But it also evokes our capacity to live, along with Zelina and Mazzetto, in a world in which our internal parents are loved with ordinary ambivalence and not supplanted. No wonder we are disturbed by this contact with our own deeply buried motives. And no wonder that, because we become excited by and complicit in Giovanni's manic evasions, we, like Kierkegaard at one point, want to turn a blind eye and to believe that Giovanni is simply the personification of vitality. Thank you.
Thank you very much. A very convincing account. I, for one, will want to listen again to the opera. A story of horror, really. Any comments or questions? Again, if I could ask you to introduce yourself.
My name's Luna Madsen. I'm a clarinetist. And it's very interesting that Mozart had that insight. How did he have the insight, the genius, to know that the character that you have seen in this book?
Bumbling kind of genius fool. How would he have the insight to create the music that fitted those characters so well? It was amazing. Do you have any ideas about that?
Well, I mean, he can only have drawn upon it on his own experience, I think. Now, Da Ponte, the librettist, is well known to have been sexually highly promiscuous until into his 80s when he moved to New York and opened a grocery store. Mozart had, you know, there are rumours about his sexual promiscuity and so on. I mean, there's an interesting quote from Kierkegaard at one point. If I can find it, I'll read it to you, because I think it's got some... It touches on exactly with the question you're asking. He asks, he says, what is a poet? By poet he means artist or musician or anybody. What is a poet? He says, a poet is an unhappy being whose heart is torn by secret sufferings, but whose lips are so strangely formed that when the sighs and the cries escape them, they sound like beautiful music. And the crowd about the poet, crowd round the poet, and say to him, sing for us soon again. That is as much to say, may new sufferings torment your soul.
That's beautiful. So in other words, I should know that. Hmm? I'm Danish, I should know that.
Thank you, but in other words, from his own experiences, is really the
so
answer.
So you're saying that he was probably the manic guy. He was manic as well.
Well, on the one hand, but also the person who could understand intuitively the complexity of the pain underlying it, both wishing to be the seducer, understanding the damage that causes. So he's not simply the manic. He's not Don Giovanni, but he has Don Giovanni somewhere in order to write that sort of music.
I'm sure many of us had the same question in mind, so thank you for starting with that.
I'm Liliana Pasterska. I am psychiatrist and a poet. To ask this question, it seemed to me, it's also to ask the question of insight of Shakespeare, of insight of Milton's, and so on. So my question would be, how is it, do we think, that the poet, the artist, an artist, finds a way into unconscious so well, and we wait for Freud to do it centuries later? I wonder whether it wouldn't be, because there are the common elements in our unconscious. There are the conflicts which Freud described, which are really common to all of us. And I wonder whether that isn't the reason why this opera is so powerful. Because she doesn't let us have a look so much into our conscious understanding of life and death wish. Mm. It plugs straight into our unconscious of the things which we either don't know or prefer not to know or know in the way which isn't really knowing.
Mm. No, I completely agree. And Freud would have agreed, of course. I mean, he didn't think he invented the unconscious. I mean, he thought that Shakespeare had written, you know, sure, Hamlet onwards, was writing about these sorts of things. He systematized it in a sense. Mendelssohn said this interesting thing, doesn't he? He said the thing with music is that it's more precise than words, emotionally more precise. And I'm sure what you're saying is true, that all of these people are writing very in touch through their own experience with their own unconscious, although they wouldn't have put it in that way. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It sums up the nub of what we're talking about today, I think. Before I come here, there was a comment from the front.
I think it's there.
Yes,
here.
Yes.
Yes, thank you, Richard. I agree with everything you say in terms of your interpretation of the Giovanni character. I just wanted to add another possible perspective, and that is the suggestion that his serial sexual behavior towards women is not only running away or defending from his sense of guilt, but also from some suppressed homosexuality. And I'm saying that partly because of the intensity of his relationship and identification with Leporello, who is his alter ego, in a sense. But there is, I think, some hidden evidence of it in one line in the catalogue that Leporello reads out and that we've heard earlier, when he says, "Pur che porti la gonnella," as long as she has, as having listed all the different kind of women he would seduce, says, as long as this character has a skirt. And that to me is you know, reveals the fact that perhaps the character he's really unconsciously attracted to would not wear a skirt. But it's just another perspective. It's not the only one. And I'm far from suggesting that all seducer of women are suppressed homosexuals, at least not any more than anybody else. Thank you.
Thank you. Through negation, really. He reveals it. Yes, exactly. Very interesting. Thank you.
Underlines the idea that everything is possible all at once. I mean, do you have any thoughts about that, Richard?
Well, it's just interesting. Andrea is working on Freud's idea of negation, that you know, say he's got to have a skirt, introduces these other possibilities of what's been denied. And it's certainly true that the intensity of his relationship with Leporello and swapping clothes with him, dressing up as him and so on, has got an envy, but possibly a sexual attraction in it. And from Leporello's point of view, maybe as well. But thank you. Yeah.
I'm Giorgio Giaccardi, I'm a Jungian analyst. I wonder if you could say something more about the pathology of the women falling for Don Giovanni. As you think, you started saying that many women find Don Giovanni very attractive somehow, or mysteriously attractive, or they feel themselves drawn to this character, or erotically aroused. And I think, yeah, we can see the pathology on both levels, really. Don Giovanni and all the women, they don't get transformed either. They're always the same. Why do they act like containers for his projective identification without opposing anything back to that projection? Is there something to say about that side of the story as well?
Well, that's a really interesting point of view. It'd be interesting to hear what people think. I mean, they do push back against it. I mean, in a way, that's the story of the opera. Anna and Elvira
and then they cave in again.
Well, I think it's the appeal of the narcissistic object, isn't it? That he arouses or evokes what is lack in all of us. Yeah. To get Lacanian for a moment, you know, there's lack in everybody, and that to see somebody who might restore and fill and complement and restore, make you a whole object again, must be a fantasy that appeals to all of us. I mean, if he was a patient, you know, he would have a better iPhone than you, sort of thing, you know. You'd be envying his iPhone, you know, and you wouldn't get him into treatment very easily, I don't think. But I don't know, did you have any ideas particularly about the women? I mean,
I was thinking from a post-Jungian point of view, that would be a missed opportunity to be initiated into outside the state of innocence, of naivety. In a way, Don Giovanni might be the potential initiator to a betrayal of a state of naturality, of sentiment, but they fall for it and they don't get changed either. Each woman is a repetition of the previous one, and none of them gets initiated outside the state of naivety. So in a way, it's a failed initiation for women, I think, one way of looking at that, which he might succeed. A bit like the story of Bluebeard, you know. again, that sense of the need for this woman to see the room with the dead bodies and to be initiated to a psychological experience. And what does she make of that? She tries to escape,
Elvira,
to run away.
Elvira
tries. She's trying.
She tries, but she repetitively falls.
Yes.
Donna Anna doesn't fall, I don't think, again. I mean, that's the difference between them. By the end of the opera, I think she's in a different state of mind.
Perhaps because she has paid the big price, the loss of her father.
Well, that may be. Interesting. Thanks.
We have time for another question or comment. Yes.
Thank you. Beate Perret, a pianist and music scholar. The quote that you just read about the beauty of music recalled another quote by Mozart himself. I don't have it literally in mind, but he says somewhere very clearly that no matter what emotion you express, even if it's violence, the music should never turn into violence. The music itself does not turn into violence. And I wonder whether that has not very much to do with the time in which Mozart wrote and the kind of compositional procedures that he followed, because they were bound to a kind of network of conventions that don't really apply for later composers. And that brings me to the question of the reading of the character of John Giovanni. I personally wasn't aware that there are loads of people who kind of idealize John Giovanni, men and women. I wasn't aware of that. But there is a real... it's not easy, I think, to go beyond the sheer joy that one can have by listening to a whole range of numbers by Don Giovanni and still keep that distance, as you've now demonstrated, to say that, no, you know, don't go for it. It is actually quite empty. So some of those cadential moments, for example, they are quite empty. And when Mozart is humorous, you can hear that. But in Don Giovanni, it's not that blatant, I think. So I wonder how you, as a psychoanalyst and clearly a very musical listener, how do you draw that boundary? How do you know always that this is really, Mozart wanted to portray John Giovanni now as somebody really empty?
Well, you're listening within a framework of the classical conventions, as you say. And so that something that's repetitively tonic dominant and so on will be different from music that's more complex. Now, even within his classical language, as it were, with his vocabulary, there's a whole range of expressiveness, isn't there? Maybe not violent, although in some ways, some of the music of the stone guest scene, I don't know whether Mozart would have thought it was violent, I would have thought he might, actually. he introduced a sort of emotional intensity, which you might not call violent, but I thought that's one of the wonderful things about Mozart, is that from one point of view, he's sort of conventionally classical. A lot of them, you know, you can listen to a piano sonata and think, oh, well, that could be written by anybody, Clementi or somebody. But there are other moments where he introduces some, as often happens in the piano concertos, some abrupt moment of timelessness where something quite different happens. And I think that he's expressing something which goes beyond the conventions. Now, you can analyze that, you know, if you've got time and certain interest in harmonic terms, like I tried to do a bit. But I think that he's working in a classical vocabulary, but he pushes it as far as he can, I think, to transcend it or to express things like despair and fury and so on, that we've been, and emptiness. Anyway, thank you.
I could just thank you again, Richard, for a wonderful session. So during the lunch break, if you want to wander down to the museum.
Deutsches Requiem, one of my favorite choral pieces. The invitation to contribute to this day conference on music and psychoanalysis, for which I'm grateful to Tom DeRose and to the Freud Museum, offers me an opportunity to reflect upon some of the links between two of the which over some three decades have occupied much of my time and which I feel most passionate about. Before focusing on the experiential aspects of what it means to me to be both a practicing psychoanalyst and a choral singer, I will make a few general remarks on the importance of sounds in child development and on some of the connections between the musical and the psychoanalytic languages. I consider that bridge towards the other, I'm quoting from Pigozzi, which is the human voice, the bridge towards the other. I consider it to be of great psychological and interpersonal significance. As well as being such a bridge, the voice is, and I quote here from Saponi, the voice is in a constant relationship with what is corporeal insofar as it stems from the vibrations of the vocal cords and from the process of breathing, and at the same time with what is incorporeal, emotions, fantasies, and affects. Familiar voices and sounds during the earliest phases of human life are of crucial importance for the establishment of the sense of self. All goes back in Gilbert Rose's colorful image to opus number one, the first duet between mother and baby. Infant feeding as a prototype of nourishing interchanges and of later intimacy involves auditory contacts as well as, of course, visual, tactile, and olfactory ones. The sounds produced by the suckling child and by the mother's voice in their dialogues at the breast. Since the infant still lacks the capacity of relating to language as a semantic system, writes Noy, he is indeed responding merely to the various sound components, intensity, pitch, rhythm, and timbre. And to quote again from Saponi, the melodic bath of voices, songs, and music in which children are immersed provides them with a sound mirror, which has an important structuring function for their psychic apparatus. Now, we know that psychological growth requires mirroring. The child finds himself in the eyes of his mother. He begins to recognize his separate identity in the positive image reflected by the parental gaze. But another aspect of mirroring, in parallel to the visual one described by Winnicott, concerns the reflection of the child's voice, sounds, and noises, a process that I propose to call echoing, in parallel with mirroring. Such holding auditory reflection will eventually allow the child not just to produce sounds, but also to listen to them, enjoy them, and recognize them as his own. For echoing to take place, his carers, empathic ear and containing voice, are indispensable sounding boards or resonant boxes to the child's own voice. Only by being talked and listened to by those who love him, the child will feel sufficiently supported to learn to listen to himself, both literally and metaphorically, and thus gradually develop an individual identity. I believe that this will also prove to be a main factor in his capacity for a future appreciation or even performance or composition of music. And of course, listening to one's own voice within a holding environment is what characterizes the psychoanalytic experience itself. Familiar tunes, mentally or vocally repeated, can play a role as transitional musical experiences, belonging both to the child's own self and to the external world, and facilitating a satisfactory interchange between the two. For toddlers who are learning to gradually move away from their parents and to negotiate a tolerable distance from them, sounds and voices represent a link with the safe environment that they're temporarily leaving behind in search of their own individuality and autonomy. And I'm quoting here from Nass, who says, "The use of music and sound in extending the link from mother to child is a core issue in the move towards differentiation and in the development of a sense of reality." In other words, the voice allows the child to shorten or eliminate the distance to the object, thus being at the service of fusionality, but also of separation. For Anthony Storr, an analyst who was also himself a talented musician, music derives from, and I quote, "from an emotional need for communication with other human beings, which is prior to the need for conveying objective information or exchanging ideas," end quote. Now, the need to be heard is vital also within adult relationships. If our voices and words are being ignored, I hope mine are not right now, we can feel invalidated or even annihilated in our sense of identity. The narcissistic wound resulting from this distressing experience can feel unbearable and provoke an enraged response or a withdrawal into a depressive condition. In this sense, one may wonder whether musicians, and perhaps singers more than others, are individuals particularly sensitive to the need of making themselves heard. We may also notice, by the way, that the experience of being heard in the deepest meaning of the word constitutes one of the main therapeutic factors in psychoanalysis. Our so-called talking cure is also a listening cure. The psychoanalytic setting discourages tactile and visual interchange and favors verbal communication instead. That is, the establishment of an auditory experience through the expectation of free associations from the patient and free-floating attention in the therapist, equivalent, by the way, to improvisation in music, as well as to the stream of consciousness in some literature. Both music and psychoanalysis are therefore exquisitely auditory experiences, and both require interpretations by those performing them, as well as by those listening, in order to come alive. The auditory apparatus is at the core of both psychoanalytic and musical listening. Though, to be fair, not all of our patients' utterances, or indeed our own, sound particularly musical. The tone of the therapist's voice, as well as the timing of her interventions, is often as important as her words. Pauses are as organic to the analytic free associative process as are rests to musical compositions. And silences during a session can be as intensely charged with meaning as the dynamic indication niente, nothing, in some scores is charged with sound. Indeed, the idiom we use in relation to musical form can sometimes be profitably applied to our therapeutic work. We can think metaphorically of the psychoanalytic encounter itself in musical terms, with its specific melodic, harmonic, and rhythmical patterns, its crescendo and diminuendo of emotional tension, at a largo tempo with some patients, or at a more frantic, allegro vivace with others. Some sessions may be described as presenting an initial theme followed by variations, others in terms of their chromatic or diatonic qualities, in a confident major key or in a depressive minor one, and so on, ad lib. I have been singing in choruses for almost 30 years. I remember that only 1 hour into my first rehearsal back in 1987, we were working, I remember, on Berlioz's Te Deum. I was already promising myself that I would go on singing choral music for the rest of my life, or at least as long as I had a good enough voice to do so. Since then, I have sung in more than 300 concerts, covering most of the classical repertory, from Thomas Tully's Speminalium to John Adams' Harmonium, including numerous performances of such staple works in the choral canon as Bach's Mass in B minor, Handel's Messiah, Mozart, Verdi's and Fauré's Requiems, Mendelssohn's Elijah, Orff's Carmina Burana, and Brahms' Ein Deutsches Requiem, just to mention a few. Now, to motivate me over the years in attending weekly rehearsals with almost obsessional regularity and hardly ever missing a concert, a workshop, or a tour abroad, have been, first of all, my great love of music, inherited, I think, from my late father. The chance to actively participate in it myself, despite having no formal musical education, and the sheer joy of performing wonderful choral masterpieces with other like-minded individuals. By the way, I'm happy that some of them are present here today who sing with me in the two choirs I'm at the moment involved with. Thank you for being here. For me, a valuable aspect at work during choral singing is the identification with other singers in the same section, reinforced rather than invalidated by the harmonic contrast with the other voices. Not only does the music we work on as our shared love object put us all on the same psychological wavelength, even when we are not singing in unison, but also some of our physiological functions, breathing patterns, pulse rate, adrenaline flow, hormonal changes, etc., become almost magically coordinated under the beat of the conductor's baton, thus creating in us all a most powerful feeling of physical and emotional closeness to one another, a sense of belonging in a tight community, even if we may have little in common with other singers or hardly know each other. After all, and I'm quoting from Putnam here, singing together like bowling together does not require shared ideology or shared social or ethnic provenance. The experience of choral singing involving the body alongside the mind is also attractive to me because of its fascinatingly complex relationship with my daily psychoanalytic work. I shall mention here some of its main manifestations. Between the two activities, there are, of course, striking differences. For instance, the loneliness of the psychoanalytic work in my consulting room is in contrast with being part of a large chorus. Those I have been involved with have all been of about 100 members. As a result, letting it all out through my voice as a singer, after having taken it all in with my listening as an analyst, has for me a powerful liberating effect. And while our music performances take place in front of audiences, the analytic work does not. The very private, intimate activity of listening to one's analysis associations is in many respects the reverse to the very public exhibition of our singing voices to an audience. Furthermore, the fact that choral singing involves working towards a clear, not too distant aim, the concert, is in contrast with the frustrations, or at least the uncertainty of results, of open-ended, long-term analytic work. A well-deserved triumph, for once, of the pleasure principle over the reality one. The parallels and similarities are also worth noticing. While attending to patients is a mostly intellectual activity and singing a mostly physical one, both require intense mental concentration and involve strong emotional components, often colored by transference and countertransference features. When singing, I can sometimes indulge in the pleasantly regressive dependence reminiscent of the transferential one between analyst and patient, on the chorus as a whole, and on the parental figure of the conductor, someone who incidentally needs to be not just a talented musician, but also a true leader. Fair, appreciative of our strengths and tolerant of our weaknesses, authoritative without being authoritarian, and with a sound, forgive the pun, a sound understanding of group dynamics. Alongside the conductor as an obvious transference object for the chorus, the accompanist with his or her piano and at dress rehearsals and concerts, the soloist and the orchestra with their instruments, not to mention the venues themselves where we sing, have important transferential functions to play. As a whole, they offer to the musical process something similar to what is provided to the therapeutic one by a containing and reliable analytic setting. Besides, as my psychoanalytic colleague and fellow choral singer Marie Bridge has suggested, listening to other parts at the same time as to one's own has a parallel with listening to a patient while also listening to one's own countertransference. Trust is here an essential component. For therapists, their trust in the analytic process. For the individual singers, their trust in their chorus. Mary Bridge gives an example of such trust what happens when in a long musical phrase, singers stagger their breathing in a spontaneously unsynchronized way so that, she says, the legato is maintained as if there were no breath. Unlike in the case of most other activities, musical ones included, psychoanalysis and singing require no specific tools or instruments. With the only exception of a chair and a couch for the former, and of printer's scores and a pencil for the latter. All that is needed for their practice are the bodies and the voices they produce. Both activities are ultimately centered upon the creative expression and vocal communication of emotionally charged meanings. In analysis facilitated by the theoretical, technical, and ethical principles regulating its practice, in singing by the compositional and performing conventions of the music to which the texts are set. I remember Sir Michael Tippett insisting with us during a rehearsal, was back on the 18th of May 1994, of his oratorio, A Child of Our Time, that he said what most matters is to tell it as a story. Something which may apply to sung music forms such as choral works, operas, or lieder in a more explicit way than it does to purely instrumental ones, such as sonatas, concertos, or symphonies. In more general terms, choral singing can itself have a containing function, perhaps especially evident in connection to the bass section, singers from the other voices, sopranos, contraltos, and tenors, often refer to as basses as contributing a supportive foundation from underneath, so to speak, to their own performances. It is a well-known phenomenon that music can have therapeutic qualities by filling space and time with sounds which transforms the making of it and listening to it into psychologically enriching experiences in both performers and audiences, making them smile or moving them to tears, calming their anxieties and lifting their depressions, even allowing them to make important discoveries about themselves. I have made here a few psychoanalytically informed observations about music and about singing in particular, focusing on the importance of the voice in early development, in the formation of the sense of identity, and in human communication in general. However, I also have some sympathy for the position expressed by a colleague whom I often meet at concerts. I already spend my whole day putting what I hear into words, and I don't want to have to do the same with music, he said. Having put into words some aspects of my own experience of being an analyst who sings in a chorus, I can accept that there may be valid reasons for keeping my interest in or passion for these two activities in separate compartments. And to argue that music, perhaps the most abstract of all art forms, the asemantic language par excellence, as Perale put it, belongs to an almost sacred universe where it should be enjoyed and then left alone.
Sing together in unison, their heart rhythms synchronize.
Yeah.
And this is due to the fact that when we breathe in, our hearts slightly accelerate. When we breathe out, our heart rates slightly decelerate. And so this mechanism is one of coordinated breathing, that follows from singing the same tune together. A very remarkable demonstration of the embodiment of music, since we are all our own instrument when we sing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, any comments or questions? Hand up straight away.
I've just been... Is that on? Oh, I'm Julie Sutton. I've been a music therapist for 30 years and more recently became a psychoanalytic psychotherapist. And I was thinking about the space that's we're occupying today, along with the different levels of experience and thinking. And one of the things I keep coming back to is the space that music therapists occupy, which is the one you've all been talking about today. But particularly the links with improvisation, which was, it was so refreshing to hear that, because you improvise when you perform from a score anyway, you know, in this, these very subtle changes in, no performance is the same, hopefully, as no analytic session is the same. And I was wondering about the links between improvisation in what is created in the clinic room and the musical, trying to think of the word, being a musician, they always leave me, the music that's in the room and the music between people, the kinds of things you've been talking about, which is present in silence as well, especially if the frame is a musical frame, I think. So it's a sort of random collection of thoughts, but trying to capture some of that space.
Is the main issue about the significance of improvisation, yeah, both in music and in therapy?
Yeah, thanks for that. Because, in fact, when I mentioned improvisation, I was actually thinking about jazz music. Mm-hmm. But thanks for adding to it the fact that we any performance, in fact, involves, even if, when we perform from a score, whether as an instrumentalist or indeed even as a singer, there is an element of improvisation in the sense that we contribute something personal, individual, that is alive in that particular moment, in that particular context, in front of that particular audience, and so on and so forth. It may not be somewhere else. And as you say, every performance is a different one. So thanks for this. As I said, I was thinking more limited terms, literally of improvisation as is the case in jazz, but of course one could even object to that and suggest that even in jazz it's not real improvisation, because it's always, even when we improvise, it's, or they improvise, I'm not a jazz musician myself, but they always, again, follow certain traditions, certain patterns, certain personal ways of dealing the material and so on. So, but the issue of improvisation is certainly a fascinating.
Lots of
so I will be very brief in my responses. Right. Then. I'd rather listen to others than.
It's a very brief question, really. I was thinking about of what you were saying about intangibility of music and its embodiment of something which is intangible, and I wondered about similar situation in a consulting room, when it isn't quite what is said that we want to only listen to. We listen to the intangible, which is in the way it is being said and it's not being said. And I wondered whether you would say that embodiment of that aspect of the session, whether there is a similarity between these two intangibilities and our perception and production.
Yeah, about embodiment, I could just say that we should never forget that in the consulting room there are also two bodies, among many other things, so let's remember that. And as to the fact that there isn't just the text of the communication, but there is also the subtext. There are the lines and also what is between the lines. And yet we should remember also the lines themselves. I mean, I think that's people think of psychoanalysis as just wanting to find other meanings and other interpretations. But it's not just about the latent content of the dream. It's also the manifest one and how the manifest and the latent interact with each other. A psychoanalyst called Theodore Reich many years ago wrote about listening with a third ear, meaning allowing the analyst unconscious to resonate with the patient's unconscious. That's absolutely fine. That's what we do day in and day out. But we should listen with the other 2 years as well.
Yes.
That's my point.
Thank you.
I found it very beautiful what you were saying about the duet between the mother and the baby, and the way the expressiveness of their voices precedes any objective reference to anything at all. It's just pure feeling, really. This made me recall, there is a book out, isn't there, called The Singing Neanderthals. I think it's by Methan or somebody with a name like Mython. And his hypothesis is that we sang before we spoke because the emotional content and the keeping contact is a more primary thing than referring to things around us. I just wonder whether you'd like to comment on that.
No, other than I agree. I mean, I can't remember whether I started by singing or talking when I was a baby, but I guess music was there somewhere.
And the extremes of pitch between low and high. If a child, it doesn't have people who make those wonderful noises, you know, at a certain threshold of their neurology, they speak on a monotone for their lifetime, don't they?
Yeah.
So it is so crucial.
I think it's worth remembering also that a baby's auditory system is fully formed in the third trimester of pregnancy.
Yes.
And so the sound environment of the unborn child is equally.
Yes, of course.
More than the visual one.
Well.
Actually, I wanted to say something about that. Actually, I think it's for the fourth month that the child can already hear. And I'm thinking of the echoing stage preceding the mirror stage, perhaps, you know, from Lacanian perspective. Obviously, the sound environment precedes the visual one. So that in a way also integrates the Lacanian idea of the first mirroring, which is actually an acoustic one. And also I was thinking in terms of the fetus, which is always in contact with the mother on any level, nourishment, but the voice, because sometimes the mother speaks, sometimes the mother doesn't. And the silence of the mother is a first signifier of the mother's absence for the fetus. So it's the first experience when we encounter separateness. The absence. The mother has always beat, the nourishment always arrives, but the voice is not always there. The sound is intermittent. So that's the first signifier of absence. I think there is a work of an Italian analyst, I don't know if you're familiar with, specifically on this point, the acoustic is, Susan Maiello. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. So she makes this point, which I think is very, very important.
But I think the point you were making is also that the voice may be absent, but the sound is constantly present during pregnancy in the experience of the baby or the fetus, because the heart beats and because all sorts of things, digestion, all sorts of noises are constantly present. So fetuses live in what I think I called earlier a bath of sound.
Lady over here.
I'm Ruth Pittman, retired psychotherapist. I wondered if anybody could say anything about the kinds of music that came into my mind when I was working with different patients, if there's anybody who can say anything about that.
Andrea, are there any associations to music for you as you're working with patients?
Don Giovanni, yes. more than Moses, let's say. Yes.
But could I come back to you about that? Is that something that was a feature for you?
It's puzzled me always where suddenly a piece of music will come into my mind when I'm working with somebody, and it's usually something to do with it. Of course, it's something to do with that person. But I haven't got any further with it.
No.
Yeah, but it might also depend on what I was rehearsing the night before.
No,
there's
nothing to do with that.
Nothing to do with that. All right.
I just want to sort of put to you, I mean, related to music, something about I mean, there's sound and there's a sensuality, there's a primitive, but they also the precociousness of the symbolic. Again, it's perhaps a reference to Lacan. In that music, most of the music we've listened to is incredibly complex. The structures, it's highly structured and complex. And, you know, and it can only appeal to us and make some sort of sense, whatever we mean by sense there, in terms of the structures that there are, even if they're quite simple structures. And also, you know, I think Richard mentioned Mozart's father. What precedes the infant, which are the sort of the wishes and the ambitions and the desires of the father or the mother or the grandfather and mother for the infant, and then what they become. I mean, Mozart, I think his first symphony was written in London when he was about 8 years old, and it's already got a structure around it. So I just want to sort of throw that in. Maybe you could say something about that.
No, I mean, thanks for that contribution. I'd rather hear what other people
I'm Eleanor Richards. I'm a psychotherapist and also a music therapist. And I want to go back to thinking about improvisation and thinking that I think implicit in what you've said is that what the mother and the infant do at the very beginning is a first experience of improvising. And then later on, I think in the consulting room, we meet patients who can't improvise, who feel very stuck and who both internally and externally are being very repetitive. One of the traditions in music therapy practice, in particularly in this country, is to work with improvised music with patients, just have instruments in the room and work with sound. And I think it's very striking that sometimes people find themselves outside the language, suddenly surprising themselves with new sounds, and that improvisation outside language can be a way into finding then other ways of symbolizing. But I was also thinking about structures and thinking about actually what was said before in that wonderful paper about Don Giovanni and about Donna Anna's music, where maybe within that rather formal sort of 18th century idiom that she's got, she's kind of surprises herself with those rather bizarre modulations and things that happen. And there's something about a fairly sort of settled frame, which might be the frame of the room and the space and the time, but also certain kinds of musical frame, which then allow quite surprising things to happen, which may then find their way into consciousness, but they start in a quite musical place, whether that's actually in musical sounds or in other accounts of music, but that's where they begin.
But that's interesting also in the context of what you were saying earlier about there are those structures which are to some yes. extent predictable, and then there is the improvisation. Yes. And the surprise that isn't. And I think that reflects very much also our work. We have, in a sense, we are almost trained not to be surprised by anything. You know, we've seen it all or we've heard it all. We are not surprised by the strange perversions of the human mind and of human behavior. And yet, we are only good analysts, I think, when we allow ourselves to be surprised by something new all
exactly.
the time.
And yes. it's
this,
yes.
this tension between the two that is what I find so exciting about psychoanalysis, but maybe also about music, that all of a sudden a change of key or whatever, you know, leaves us amazed.
Yeah.
We have time just for one more. This gentleman, is that? Sorry to choose.
No, there was the one in front was before, actually. But,
oh, really? Yeah, anyway.
Have them both. Have them both. Okay.
I wondered about time. I mean, a number of things that you said, Andrea, imply the importance of time. And one of the most important things about music, I'm a sociologist, by the way, my name is Paul Filmer. And so what interests me is the importance of keeping in time together and the role that music plays in keeping in time together. Now, you mentioned, obviously, the discipline of singing in a choir. And keeping in time together there, but I wonder if there's any parallel there in the analytic situation, other than everybody looking at the clock for different reasons. Yes. When 50 minutes comes up.
Yes, yes, very much so. In fact, issues of time and time in psychoanalysis have been at the center of my own personal interest, and I've written quite a lot about time in psychoanalysis. And it's no coincidence, I think, that also my interest in music. Time is central to it, and it's our it's again the meeting of our own internal time and our own internal rhythms, our own internal understanding of the musical rhythm and the music itself, the external, that is fascinating when they two actually meet together. Singing together is one, and indeed I am sure playing together for instrumentalists. I remember Anthony Storr actually saying he used to play, I think, in a quartet or quintet, and that there is no closer, more intimate relationship among people, he couldn't think, than that can be established between an ensemble playing together or singing together over time. And I'm sure that as well as this, the emotional similarities and the physiological coordination of, for instance, a heartbeat or hormonal changes and so on, there is also the fact that we all share the same time and try and live the time through the music.
Just one more.
Yes. The gentleman behind Paul.
I'm actually one of Andrea's students at UCL, Attila Kulcher. Just to add something, there was a UCL team that did an experiment with Stephen Fry and Alan Davis at the Royal Opera House a couple of years ago, and they found that in the audience too, there's this synchronicity of heartbeats. So it really makes you begin to wonder, is that synchronicity between actually the audience and the singers all together? But they kind of hadn't got beyond that. And then actually as a follow-on to that lady's point about thinking of music, Daniel Barenboim was giving the Edward Said lecture a couple of weeks ago. And he came out with this obvious thing that I'd never really thought about. Music is a metaphor for life. And for him, that means not just that when you hear music, you think of kind of moments in your life, but that also when you're living moments in life, particular music comes to you. So it's that two-way process that maybe the deeper we get into music, the more we have that two-way flow.
There's a remarkable book by Dennis Noble, an Oxford cardiologist, called The Music of Life, in which he says that music provides a metaphor for living systems as a whole. So I think that's a very powerful idea, that the whole metaphoric significance of music.
Yeah.
So I think we should break for lunch. Thank you again.
Thank you.